Books on Tape presents A Death in Vienna by Daniel Silva. Read by John Lee. In a place where wood is chopped, splinters must fall, and there is no avoiding this. SS Gruppenführer Heinrich Müller, head of the Gestapo. We're not in the Boy Scouts. If we'd wanted to be in the Boy Scouts, we would have joined the Boy Scouts. Richard Helms, former CIA director. Part 1. The Man from Café Central. Chapter 1. Vienna. The office is hard to find, and intentionally so. Located near the end of a narrow, curving lane in a quarter of Vienna more renowned for its nightlife than its tragic past, the entrance is marked only by a small brass plaque bearing the inscription, Wartime Claims and Inquiries. The security system, installed by an obscure firm based in Tel Aviv, is formidable and highly visible. A camera glowers menacingly from above the door. No one is admitted without an appointment and a letter of introduction. Visitors must pass through a finely tuned magnetometer. Purses and briefcases are inspected with unsmiling efficiency by one of two disarmingly pretty girls. One is called Rebecca, the other Sarah. Once inside, the visitor is escorted along a claustrophobic corridor lined with gunmetal grey filing cabinets, then into a large, typically Viennese chamber with pale floors, a high ceiling, and bookshelves bowed beneath the weight of countless volumes and file folders. The donnish clutter is appealing, though some are unnerved by the green-tinted bulletproof windows overlooking the melancholy courtyard. The man who works there is untidy and easily missed. It is his special talent. Sometimes, as you enter, he is standing atop a library ladder, rummaging for a book. Usually, he is seated at his desk, wreathed in cigarette smoke, peering at the stack of paperwork and files that never seems to diminish. He takes a moment to finish a sentence or jot a loose minute in the margin of a document, then he rises and extends his tiny hand, his quick brown eyes flickering over you. Eli Lavon, he says modestly as he shakes your hand, though everyone in Vienna knows who runs Wartime Claims and Inquiries. Were it not for Lavon's well-established reputation, his appearance, a shirt front chronically smeared with ash, a shabby burgundy-coloured cardigan with patches on the elbows and a tattered hem, might prove disturbing. Some suspect he is without sufficient means. Others imagine he is an ascetic, or even slightly mad. One woman who wanted help winning restitution from a Swiss bank concluded he was suffering from a permanently broken heart. How else to explain that he had never been married? The air of bereavement that is sometimes visible when he thinks no one is looking. Whatever the visitor's suspicions, the result is usually the same. Most cling to him for fear he might float away. He points you toward the comfortable couch. He asks the girls to hold his calls, then places his thumb and forefinger together and tips them toward his mouth. Coffee, please. Out of earshot, the girls quarrel about whose turn it is. Rebecca is an Israeli from Haifa, olive-skinned and black-eyed, stubborn and fiery. Sarah is a well-heeled American Jew from the Holocaust Studies program at Boston University. More cerebral than Rebecca, and therefore more patient. She is not above resorting to deception or even outright lies to avoid a chore she believes is beneath her. Rebecca, honest and temperamental, is easily outmaneuvered, and so it is usually Rebecca who joylessly plunks a silver tray on the coffee table and retreats in a sulk. Lavon has no set formula for how to conduct his meetings. He permits the visitor to determine the course. He is not averse to answering questions about himself, and if pressed, explains how it came to be that one of Israel's most talented young archaeologists chose to sift through the unfinished business of the Holocaust rather than the troubled soil of his homeland. His willingness to discuss his past, however, goes only so far. He does not tell visitors that, for a brief period in the early 1970s, he worked for Israel's notorious secret service, or that he is still regarded as the finest street surveillance artist the service has ever produced, or that twice a year, when he returns to Israel to see his aged mother, he visits a highly secure facility north of Tel Aviv to share some of his secrets with the next generation. Inside the service, he is still referred to as the Ghost. His mentor, a man called Ari Shamron, always said that Eli Levon could disappear while shaking your hand. It was not far from the truth. He is quiet around his guests, just as he was quiet around the men he stalked for Shamron. He is a chain smoker, but if it bothers the guest, he will refrain. A polyglot, he listens to you in whatever language you prefer. His gaze is sympathetic and steady, though behind his eyes it is sometimes possible to detect puzzle pieces sliding into place. He prefers to hold all questions until the visitor has completed his case. His time is precious, and he makes decisions quickly. He knows when he can help. He knows when it is better to leave the past undisturbed. Should he accept your case, he asks for a small sum of money to finance the opening stages of his investigation. He does so with noticeable embarrassment, and if you cannot pay, he will waive the fee entirely. He receives most of his operating funds from donors, but wartime claims is hardly a profitable enterprise, and Levon is chronically strapped for cash. The source of his funding has been a contentious issue in certain circles of Vienna, where he is reviled as a troublesome outsider financed by international Jewry, always sticking his nose into places it doesn't belong. There are many in Austria who would like wartime claims to close its doors for good. It is because of them that Eli Levon spends his days behind green, bulletproof glass. On a snow-swept evening in early January, Levon was alone in his office, hunched over a stack of files. There were no visitors that day. In fact, it had been many days since Levon had accepted appointments, the bulk of his time being consumed by a single case. At 7 o'clock, Rebecca poked her head through the door. "We're hungry," she said with typical Israeli bluntness. "Get us something to eat." Levon's memory, while impressive, did not extend to food orders. Without looking up from his work, he waved his pen in the air as though he were writing, "Make me a list, Rebecca." A moment later, he closed the file and stood up. He looked out his window and watched the snow settling gently onto the black bricks of the courtyard. Then he pulled on his overcoat, wrapped a scarf twice around his neck, and placed a cap atop his thinning hair. He walked down the hall to the room where the girls worked. Rebecca's desk was a skyline of German military files. Sarah, the eternal graduate student, was concealed behind a stack of books. As usual, they were quarreling. Rebecca wanted Indian from a takeaway just on the other side of the Danube Canal. Sarah craved pasta from an Italian café on the Kartnerstrasse. Levon, oblivious, studied the new computer on Sarah's desk.
"When did that arrive?" he asked, interrupting their debate.
"This morning."
"Why do we have a new computer?"
"Because you bought the old one when the Habsburgs still ruled Austria."
"Did I authorize the purchase of a new computer?"
The question was not threatening. The girls managed the office, papers were placed beneath his nose, and usually he signed them without looking. "No, Eli, you didn't approve the purchase. My father paid for the computer." Levon smiled.
"Your father is a generous man. Please thank him on my behalf."
The girls resumed their debate. As usual, it resolved in Sarah's favor. Rebecca wrote out the list and threatened to pin it to Levon's sleeve. Instead, she stuffed it into his coat pocket for safekeeping, and gave him a little shove to send him on his way.
"And don't stop for a coffee," she said. "We're starving."
It was almost as difficult to leave wartime claims and inquiries as it was to enter. Levon punched a series of numbers into a keypad on the wall next to the entrance. When the buzzer sounded, he pulled open the interior door and stepped into the security chamber. The outer door would not open until the inner door had been closed for 10 seconds. Levon put his face to the bulletproof glass and peered out. On the opposite side of the street, concealed in the shadows at the entrance of a narrow alleyway, stood a heavy-shouldered figure with a fedora hat and Macintosh raincoat. Eli Lavon could not walk the streets of Vienna, or any other city for that matter, without ritualistically checking his tail and recording faces that appeared too many times in too many disparate situations. It was a professional affliction. Even from a distance, and even in the poor light, he knew that he had seen the figure across the street several times during the last few days. He sorted through his memory, almost as a librarian would sort through a card index, until he found references to previous sightings. "Yes, here it is. The Judenplatz, 2 days ago. It was you who was following me after I had coffee with that reporter from the States." He returned to the index and found a second reference. The window of a bar along the Sterngasse. Same man, without the fedora hat, gazing casually over his pilsner as Lavon hurried through a biblical deluge after a perfectly wretched day at the office. The third reference took him a bit longer to locate, but he found it nonetheless. The number 2 streetcar, evening rush. Lavon is pinned against the doors by a florid-faced Viennese who smells of bratwurst and apricot schnapps. Fedora has somehow managed to find a seat and is calmly cleaning his nails with his ticket stub. He is a man who enjoys cleaning things, Lavon had thought at the time. Perhaps he cleans things for a living. Lavon turned round and pressed the intercom. No response. "Come on, girls." He pressed it again, then looked over his shoulder. The man in the fedora and Macintosh coat was gone. A voice came over the speaker. "Rebecca."
"Did you lose the list already, Eli?"
Lavon pressed his thumb against the button.
"Get out! Now!"
A few seconds later, Lavon could hear the trample of footfalls in the corridor. The girls appeared before him, separated by a wall of glass. Rebecca coolly punched in the code. Sarah stood by silently, her eyes locked on Lavon's, her hand on the glass. He never remembered hearing the explosion. Rebecca and Sarah were engulfed in a ball of fire, then were swept away by the blast wave. The door blew outward. Lavon was lifted like a child's toy, arms spread wide, back arched like a gymnast. His flight was dreamlike. He felt himself turning over and over again. He had no memory of impact. He knew only that he was lying on his back in snow, in a hailstorm of broken glass.
"My girls,"
he whispered, as he slid slowly into blackness.
"My beautiful girls."
Chapter 2. Venice. It was a small terracotta church, built for a poor parish in the sestiere of Cannareggio. The restorer paused at the side portal, beneath a beautifully proportioned lunette, and fished a set of keys from the pocket of his oilskin coat. He unlocked the studded oaken door and slipped inside. A breath of cold air, heavy with damp and old candle wax, caressed his cheek. He stood motionless in the half-light for a moment, then headed across the intimate Greek cross nave toward the small chapel of St. Jerome at the right side of the church. The restorer's gait was smooth and seemingly without effort. The slight outward bend to his legs suggested speed and sure-footedness. The face was long and narrow at the chin, with a slender nose that looked as if it had been carved from wood. The cheekbones were wide, and there was a hint of the Russian steppes in the restless green eyes. The black hair was cropped short and shot with grey at the temples. It was a face of many possible national origins, and the restorer possessed the linguistic gifts to put it to good use. In Venice, he was known as Mario Del Vecchio. It was not his real name. The altarpiece was concealed behind a tarpaulin-draped scaffold. The restorer took hold of the aluminum tubing and climbed silently upward. His work platform was as he had left it the previous afternoon, his brushes and his palette, his pigments and his medium. He switched on a bank of fluorescent lamps. The painting, the last of Giovanni Bellini's great altarpieces, glowed under the intense lighting. At the left side of the image stood St. Christopher, the Christ child, straddling his shoulders. Opposite stood St. Louis of Toulouse, a crozier in hand, a bishop's mitre atop his head,
his shoulders draped in a cape of red and gold brocade. Above it all, on a second parallel plane, Saint Jerome sat before an open book of Psalms, framed by a vibrant blue sky streaked with grey-brown clouds. Each saint was separated from the other, alone before God. The isolation so complete it was almost painful to observe. It was an astonishing piece of work for a man in his 80s. The restorer stood motionless before the towering panel, like a fourth figure rendered by Bellini's skilled hand, and allowed his mind to float away into the landscape. After a moment, he poured a puddle of Mowalith 20 medium onto his palette, added pigment, then thinned the mixture with Arcosolve until the consistency and intensity felt right. He looked up again at the painting. The warmth and richness of the colours had led the art historian Raimond von Marler to conclude the hand of Titian was clearly in evidence. The restorer believed von Marler, with all due respect, was sadly mistaken. He had retouched works by both artists, and knew their brushwork like the sunlines around his own eyes. The altarpiece in the Church of San Giovanni Crisostomo was Bellini's, and Bellini's alone. Besides, at the time of its production, Titian was desperately attempting to replace Bellini as Venice's most important painter. The restorer sincerely doubted Giovanni would have invited the young, headstrong Titian to assist in so important a commission. Von Marler, had he done his homework, would have saved himself the embarrassment of so ludicrous an opinion. The restorer slipped on a pair of binomags and focused on the rose-colored tunic of St. Christopher. The painting had suffered from decades of neglect, wild temperature swings, and the continuous onslaught of incense and candle smoke. Christopher's garments had lost much of their original luster, and were scarred by the islands of pentimenti that had pushed their way to the surface. The restorer had been granted authority to carry out an aggressive repair. His mission was to restore the painting to its original glory. His challenge was to do so without making it look as though it had been churned out by a counterfeiter. In short, he wished to come and go, leaving no trace of his presence, to make it appear as if the retouching had been performed by Bellini himself. For 2 hours, the restorer worked alone, the silence broken only by the shuffle of feet outside in the street and the rattle of rising aluminum storefronts. The interruptions began at 10 o'clock, with the arrival of the renowned Venetian altar cleaner, Adriana Zinetti. She poked her head around the restorer's shroud and wished him a pleasant morning. Annoyed, he raised his magnifying visor and peered down over the edge of his platform. Adriana had positioned herself in such a way that it was impossible to avoid gazing down the front of her blouse at her extraordinary breasts. The restorer nodded solemnly, then watched her slither up her scaffolding with feline assurance. Adriana knew he was living with another woman, a Jewess from the old ghetto, yet she still flirted with him at every opportunity, as if one more suggestive glance, or one more accidental touch, would be the one to topple his defences. Still, he envied the simplicity with which she viewed the world. Adriana loved art and Venetian food and being adored by men. Little else mattered to her. A young restorer called Antonio Politti came next, wearing sunglasses and looking hungover, a rock star arriving for yet another interview he wished to cancel. Antonio did not bother to wish the restorer good morning. Their dislike was mutual. For the Crisostomo project, Antonio had been assigned Sebastiano del Piombo's main altarpiece. The restorer believed the boy was not ready for the piece, and each evening, before leaving the church, he secretly scaled Antonio's platform to inspect his work. Francesco Tiepolo, the chief of the San Giovanni Crisostomo project, was the last to arrive, a shambling, bearded figure, dressed in a flowing white shirt and silk scarf round his thick neck. On the streets of Venice, tourists mistook him for Luciano Pavarotti. Venetians rarely made such a mistake, for Francesco Tiepolo ran the most successful restoration company in the entire Veneto region. Among the Venetian art set, he was an institution. "Buongiorno," Tiepolo sang, his cavernous voice echoing high in the central dome.
He seized the Restorer's platform with his large hand and gave it one violent shake. The Restorer peered over the side like a gargoyle. "You almost ruined an entire morning's work, Francesco."
"That's why we use isolating varnish."
Tieplo held up a white paper sack.
"Cornetto?"
"Come on up." Tieplo put a foot on the first rung of the scaffolding and pulled himself up. The Restorer could hear the aluminum tubing straining under Tieplo's enormous weight. Tieplo opened the sack, handed the Restorer an almond cornetto, and took one for himself. Half of it disappeared in one bite. The Restorer sat on the edge of the platform with his feet dangling over the side. Tieplo stood before the altarpiece and examined his work.
"If I didn't know better, I would have thought old Giovanni slipped in here last night and did the in-painting himself."
"That's the idea, Francesco."
"Yes, but few people have the gifts to actually pull it off."
The rest of the cornetto disappeared into his mouth. He brushed powdered sugar from his beard.
"When will it be finished?"
3 months, maybe four.
"From my vantage point, 3 months would be better than four. But heaven forbid I should rush the great Mario del Vecchio. Any travel plans?"
The Restorer glared at Tieplo over the cornetto, and slowly shook his head. A year earlier, he had been forced to confess his true name and occupation to Tieplo. The Italian had preserved that trust by never revealing the information to another soul, though from time to time, when they were alone, he still asked the Restorer to speak a few words of Hebrew, just to remind himself that the legendary Mario del Vecchio truly was an Israeli from the Valley of Jezreel, named Gabriel Alon. A sudden downpour hammered on the roof of the church. From atop the platform, high in the apse of the chapel, it sounded like a drum roll. Tieplo raised his hands toward the heavens in supplication.
"Another storm! God help us! They say the Acqua Alta could reach 5 feet. I still haven't dried out from the last one. I love this place, but even I don't know how much longer I can take it."
It had been a particularly difficult season for high water. Venice had flooded more than 50 times, and 3 months of winter still remained. Gabriel's house had been inundated so many times that he'd moved everything off the ground floor, and was installing a waterproof barrier around his doors and windows.
"You'll die in Venice, just like Bellini," Gabriel said,
"and I'll bury you beneath a cypress tree on San Michele, in an enormous crypt, befitting a man of your achievements." Tieplo seemed pleased with this image, even though he knew that, like most modern Venetians, he would have to suffer the indignity of a mainland burial.
"And what about you, Mario? Where will you die?"
"With a bit of luck, it will be at the time and place of my own choosing. That's about the best a man like me can hope for."
"Just do me one favor."
"What's that?" Tiepolo gazed at the scarred painting.
"Finish the altarpiece before you die. You owe it to Giovanni."
The flood sirens atop the Basilica San Marco cried out a few minutes after 4 o'clock. Gabriel hurriedly cleaned his brushes and his palette, but by the time he descended his scaffolding and crossed the nave to the front portal, the street was already running with several inches of flood water. He went back inside. Like most Venetians, he owned several pairs of rubber Wellington boots, which he stored at strategic points in his life, ready to be deployed at a moment's notice. The pair he kept in the church were his first. They'd been lent to him by Umberto Conti, the master Venetian restorer with whom Gabriel had served his apprenticeship. Gabriel had tried countless times to return them, but Umberto would never take them back.
"Keep them, Mario, along with the skills I've given you. They will serve you well, I promise."
He pulled on Umberto's faded old boots and cloaked himself in a green waterproof poncho. A moment later he was wading through the shin-deep waters of the Salizzada San Giovanni Crisostomo, like an olive-drab ghost. In the Strada Nova, the wooden gangplanks known as passerelle had yet to be laid down by the city's sanitation workers. A bad sign, Gabriel knew, for it meant the flooding was forecast to be so severe the passerelle would float away. By the time he reached the Rio Terra San Leonardo, the water was nearing his boot tops. He turned into an alley, quiet except for the sloshing of the waters, and followed it to a temporary wooden footbridge spanning the Rio di Ghetto Nuovo. A ring of unlit apartment houses loomed before him, notable because they were taller than any others in Venice. He waded through a swamped passageway and emerged into a large square. A pair of bearded yeshiva students crossed his path, tiptoeing across the flooded square toward the synagogue, the fringes of their talit katan dangling against their trouser legs. He turned to his left and walked to the doorway at number 2899. A small brass plaque read, Comunità Ebraica di Venezia, Jewish Community of Venice. He pressed the bell and was greeted by an old woman's voice over the intercom. It's Mario.
She's not here.
Where is she?
Helping out at the bookstore. One of the girls was sick.
He entered a glass doorway a few paces away and lowered his hood. To his left was the entrance of the ghetto's modest museum. To the right, an inviting little bookstore, warm and brightly lit. A girl with short blonde hair was perched on a stool behind the counter, hurriedly cashing out the register before the setting of the sun made it impossible for her to handle money. Her name was Valentina. She smiled at Gabriel and pointed the tip of her pencil toward the large floor-to-ceiling window overlooking the canal. A woman was on her hands and knees, soaking up water that had seeped through the allegedly watertight seals around the glass. She was strikingly beautiful.
I told them those seals would never hold, Gabriel said. It was a waste of money.
Chiara looked up sharply. Her hair was dark and curly and shimmering with highlights of auburn and chestnut. Barely constrained by a clasp at the nape of her neck, it spilled riotously about her shoulders. Her eyes were caramel and flecked with gold. They tended to change color with her mood.
Don't just stand there like an idiot. Get down here and help me. Surely you don't expect a man of my talent?
The soaking white towel, thrown with surprising force and accuracy, struck him in the center of the chest. Gabriel wrung it out into a bucket and knelt next to her.
There's been a bombing in Vienna, Chiara whispered, her lips pressed to Gabriel's neck. He's here. He wants to see you.
The floodwaters lapped against the street entrance of the canal house. When Gabriel opened the door, water rippled across the marble hall. He surveyed the damage, then wearily followed Chiara up the stairs. The living room was in heavy shadow. An old man stood in the rain-spattered window overlooking the canal, as motionless as a figure in the Bellini. He wore a dark business suit and silver necktie. His bald head was shaped like a bullet. His face, deeply tanned and full of cracks and fissures, seemed to be fashioned out of desert rock. Gabriel went to his side. The old man did not acknowledge him. Instead, he contemplated the rising waters of the canal, his face set in a fatalistic frown, as though he were witnessing the onset of the great flood come to destroy the wickedness of man. Gabriel knew that Ari Shamron was about to inform him of death. Death had joined them in the beginning, and death remained the foundation of their bond. Chapter 3. Venice. In the corridors and conference rooms of the Israeli intelligence services, Ari Shamron was a legend. Indeed, he was the service made flesh. He had penetrated the courts of kings, stolen the secrets of tyrants, and killed the enemies of Israel, sometimes with his bare hands. His crowning achievement had come on a rainy night in May 1960, in a squalid suburb north of Buenos Aires, when he leapt from the back of a car and seized Adolf Eichmann. In September 1972, Prime Minister Golda Meir had ordered him to hunt down and assassinate the Palestinian terrorists who had kidnapped and murdered 11 Israelis at the Munich Olympic Games. Gabriel, then a promising student at the Bezalel Academy of Art in Jerusalem, reluctantly joined Shamron's venture,
fittingly codenamed Wrath of God. In the Hebrew-based lexicon of the operation, Gabriel was an Aleph. Armed only with a .22-caliber Beretta, he had quietly killed six men. Shamron's career had not been an unbroken ascent to greater glory. There had been deep valleys along the way and mistaken journeys into operational wasteland. He developed a reputation as a man who shot first and worried about the consequences later. His erratic temperament was one of his greatest assets. It struck fear into friends and enemies alike. For some politicians, Shamron's volatility was too much to bear. Rabin often avoided his calls, fearing the news he might hear. Perez thought him a primitive and banished him into the Judean wilderness of retirement. Barak, when the office was foundering, had rehabilitated Shamron and brought him back to right the ship. Officially, he was retired now, and his beloved office was in the hands of a thoroughly modern and conniving technocrat called Lev. But among many quarters, Shamron would always be the Memune, the one in charge. The current Prime Minister was an old friend and fellow traveller. He'd given Shamron a vague title and just enough authority to make a general nuisance of himself. There were some at King Saul Boulevard who swore that Lev was secretly praying for Shamron's rapid demise, and that Shamron, stubborn and steel-willed Shamron, was keeping himself alive merely to torment him. Now, standing before the window, Shamron calmly told Gabriel what he knew about the events in Vienna. A bomb had exploded the previous evening inside wartime claims and inquiries. Eli Lavon was in a deep coma in the intensive care ward of the Vienna General Hospital. The odds of survival, 1 in 2 at best. His two research assistants, Rebecca Gazit and Sarah Greenberg, had been killed in the blast. An offshoot of bin Laden's Al-Qaeda organization, a shadowy group called the Islamic Fighting Cells, had claimed responsibility. Shamron spoke to Gabriel in his murderously accented English. Hebrew was not permitted in the Venice Canal House. Chiara brought coffee and rugala to the sitting room and settled herself between Gabriel and Shamron. Of the three, only Chiara was currently under office discipline. Known as a bat levea, her work involved posing as the lover or spouse of a case officer in the field. Like all office personnel, she was trained in the art of physical combat and in the use of weaponry. The fact that she had scored higher than the great Gabriel Allon on her final firing range exam was a source of some tension in their household. Her undercover assignments often required a certain intimacy with her partner, such as showing affection in restaurants and nightclubs, and sharing the same bed in hotel rooms or safe flats. Romantic relationships between case officers and escort agents were officially forbidden, but Gabriel knew that the close living quarters and natural stress of the field often drew them together. Indeed, he had once had an affair with his bat levea while in Tunis. She'd been a beautiful Marseille Jew named Jacqueline Delacroix, and the affair had nearly destroyed his marriage. Gabriel, when Chiara was away, often pictured her in the bed of another man. Though not prone to jealousy, he secretly looked forward to the day King Saul Boulevard decided she was too overexposed for field work. "Who exactly are the Islamic fighting cells?" he asked. Shamron made a face.
"They're small-time operators mainly, active in France and a couple of other European countries. They enjoy setting fire to synagogues, desecrating Jewish cemeteries, and beating up Jewish children on the streets of Paris."
"Was there anything useful in the claim of responsibility?" Shamron shook his head.
"Just the usual drivel about the plight of the Palestinians and the destruction of the Zionist entity. It warns of continuous attacks against Jewish targets in Europe until Palestine is liberated."
"Lavon's office was a fortress. How did the group that usually uses Molotov cocktails and spray paint cans manage to get a bomb inside wartime claims and inquiries?" Shamron accepted a cup from Chiara.
"The Austrian Staatspolizei aren't sure yet, but they believe it may have been concealed in a computer delivered to the office earlier that day.
Do we believe the Islamic fighting cells have the ability to conceal a bomb in a computer and smuggle it into a secure building in Vienna?
Shamron stirred sugar violently into his coffee and slowly shook his head.
So, who did it?
Obviously, I'd like to know the answer to that question.
Shamron removed his coat and rolled up his shirt sleeves. The message was unmistakable. Gabriel looked away from Shamron's hooded gaze and thought of the last time the old man had sent him to Vienna. It was January 1991. The office had learned that an Iraqi intelligence agent operating from the city was planning to direct a string of terrorist attacks against Israeli targets to coincide with the first Persian Gulf War. Shamron had ordered Gabriel to monitor the Iraqi and, if necessary, take preemptive action. Unwilling to endure another long separation from his family, Gabriel had brought his wife Leah and young son Dani along with him. Though he didn't realize it, he had walked into a trap laid by a Palestinian terrorist named Tariq al-Hurani. Gabriel, lost in thought for a long moment, finally looked up at Shamron.
"Have you forgotten that Vienna is the forbidden city for me?"
Shamron lit one of his foul-smelling Turkish cigarettes and placed the dead match in the saucer next to his teaspoon. He pushed his eyeglasses onto his forehead and folded his arms. They were still powerful, braided steel beneath a thin layer of sagging, suntanned skin. So were the hands. The gesture was one Gabriel had seen many times before. Shamron, the unmovable. Shamron, the indomitable. He'd struck the same pose after dispatching Gabriel to Rome to kill for the first time. He'd been an old man even then. Indeed, he'd never really been young at all. Instead of chasing girls on the beach at Netanya, he'd been a unit commander in the Palmach, fighting the first battle in Israel's war without end. His youth had been stolen from him. In turn, he had stolen Gabriel's.
"I volunteered to go to Vienna myself, but Lev wouldn't hear of it. He knows that because of our regrettable history there, I'm something of a pariah. He reckoned the Staatspolizei would be more forthcoming if we were represented by a less polarizing figure."
"So your solution is to send me?"
"Not in any official capacity, of course."
These days Shamron did almost nothing in an official capacity.
"But I would feel much more comfortable if someone I trusted was keeping an eye on things."
"We have office personnel in Vienna."
"Yes, but they report to Lev."
"He is the chief."
Shamron closed his eyes, as if he were being reminded of a painful subject.
"Lev has too many other problems at the moment to give this the attention it deserves. The boy emperor in Damascus is making troublesome noises. The mullahs of Iran are trying to build Allah's bomb, and Hamas is turning children into bombs and detonating them on the streets of Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. One minor bombing in Vienna is not going to get the attention it deserves, even though the target was Eli Lavon."
Shamron stared compassionately at Gabriel over the rim of his coffee cup.
"I know you have no desire to go back to Vienna, especially after another bombing, but your friend is lying in a Viennese hospital fighting for his life. I would think you'd like to know who put him there."
Gabriel thought of the half-completed Bellini altarpiece in the Church of San Giovanni Crisostomo, and could feel it slipping away from him. Chiara had turned away from Shamron and was eyeing him intently. Gabriel avoided her gaze.
"If I went to Vienna," he said quietly, "I would need an identity."
Shamron shrugged, as if to say there were ways,
obvious ways, dear boy,
of getting around a small problem such as cover. Gabriel had expected this would be Shamron's response. He held out his hand. Shamron opened his briefcase and handed over a manila envelope. Gabriel lifted the flap and poured the contents on the coffee table. Airline tickets, a leather billfold, a well-traveled Israeli passport.
He opened the cover of the passport and saw his own face staring back at him. His new name was Gideon Argov. He'd always liked the name Gideon. What does Gideon do for a living? Shamron inclined his head toward the billfold. Among the usual items, credit cards, a driver's license, a health club, and video club membership, he found a business card. Gideon Argov, Wartime Claims and Inquiries, 17 Mendela Street, Jerusalem, 92147, 542-7618. Gabriel looked up at Shamron. I didn't know Eli had an office in Jerusalem. He does now. Try the number. Gabriel shook his head. I believe you. Does Lev know about this?
Not yet. But I plan on telling him once you're safely on the ground, in Vienna.
So we're deceiving the Austrians and the office. That's impressive, even for you, Ari. Shamron gave a sheepish smile. Gabriel opened the airline jacket and examined his travel itinerary.
I don't think it would be a good idea for you to travel directly to Vienna from here. I'll accompany you back to Tel Aviv in the morning. Separate seats, of course. You'll turn around and catch the afternoon flight into Vienna.
Gabriel lifted his gaze and stared at Shamron, his expression dubious. And if I'm recognized at the airport and dragged into a room for some special Austrian attention?
That's always a possibility. But it has been 13 years. Besides, you've been to Vienna recently. I recall a meeting we had in Eli's office last year concerning an imminent threat to the life of His Holiness, Pope Paul VII.
I have been back to Vienna, Gabriel conceded, holding up the false passport. But never like this, and never through the airport. Gabriel spent a long moment appraising the false passport with his restorer's eye. Finally he closed the cover and slipped it into his pocket. Chiara stood and walked out of the room. Shamron watched her go, then looked at Gabriel.
It seems I've managed to disrupt your life once again.
Why should this time be any different?
Do you want me to talk to her?
Gabriel shook his head. She'll get over it, he said. She's a professional. There were moments of Gabriel's life, fragments of time, which he rendered on canvas and hung in the cellar of his subconscious. To this gallery of memory he added Chiara, as he saw her now, seated astride his body, bathed in a Rembrandt's light from the street lamps beyond their bedroom window, a satin duvet bunched at her hips, her breasts bared. Other images intruded. Shamron had opened the door to them, and Gabriel, as always, was powerless to push them back. There was Vadel Adelsweiter, a skinny intellectual in a plaid jacket, whom Gabriel had killed in the foyer of an apartment house in Rome. There was Ali Abdelhamidi, who had died by Gabriel's hand in a Zurich alley, and Mahmoud Al-Hurani, older brother of Tariq Al-Hurani, whom Gabriel had shot through the eye in Cologne as he lay in the arms of a lover. A mane of hair fell across Chiara's breasts. Gabriel reached up and gently pushed it away. She looked at him. It was too dark to see the color of her eyes, but Gabriel could sense her thoughts. Shamron had trained him to read the emotions of others, just as Umberto Conti had taught him to mimic the old masters. Gabriel, even in the arms of a lover, could not suspend his ceaseless search for the warning signs of betrayal. I don't want you to go to Vienna. She placed her hands on Gabriel's chest. Gabriel could feel his heart beating against the cool skin of her palm.
It's not safe for you there. Of all people, Shamron should know that.
Shamron is right.
It was a long time ago. Yes, it was. But if you go there and start asking questions about the bombing, you'll rub up against the Austrian police and security services. Shamron is using you to keep his hand in the game. He doesn't have your best interests in mind.
You sound like a Lev man.
It's you I care about.
She bent down and kissed his mouth. Her lips tasted of blossom.
I don't want you to go to Vienna and become lost in the past. After a moment's hesitation, she added, I'm afraid I'll lose you.
To who? She lifted the duvet to her shoulders and covered her breasts. Leia's shadow fell between them. It was Kiara's intention to let her into the room. Kiara only talked about Leia in bed, where she believed Gabriel would not lie to her. Gabriel's entire life was a lie. With his lovers, he was always painfully honest. He could make love to a woman only if she knew that he had killed men on behalf of his country. He never told lies about Leia. He considered it his duty to speak honestly of her, even to the women who had taken her place in his bed.
"Do you have any idea how hard this is for me?" Kiara asked. "Everyone knows about Leia. She's an office legend, just like you and Shamron. How long am I supposed to live with the fear that one day you'll decide you can't do this anymore?"
"What do you want me to do?"
"Marry me, Gabriel. Stay in Venice and restore paintings. Tell Shamron to leave you alone. You have scars all over your body. Haven't you given enough to your country?"
He closed his eyes. Before him opened a gallery door. Reluctantly he passed through to the other side, and found himself on a street in the old Jewish quarter of Vienna with Leia and Dani at his side. They have just finished dinner. Snow is falling. Leia is on edge. There had been a television in the bar of the restaurant, and all the meal they had watched Iraqi missiles raining down on Tel Aviv. Leia is anxious to return home and telephone her mother. She rushes Gabriel's ritual search of his car's undercarriage.
"Come on, Gabriel, hurry. I want to talk to my mother. I want to hear the sound of her voice."
He rises, straps Dani into his car seat, and kisses Leia. Even now, he can still taste the olives on her mouth. He turns and starts back to the cathedral, where, as part of his cover, he is restoring an altarpiece depicting the martyrdom of St. Stephen. Leia turns the key. The engine hesitates. Gabriel spins round and screams at her to stop, but Leia can't see him because the windshield is dusted with snowfall. She turns the key again. He waited for the images of fire and blood to dissolve into blackness. Then he told Kiara what she wanted to hear. When he returned from Vienna, he would go to see Leia in the hospital and explain to her that he had fallen in love with another woman. Kiara's face darkened.
"I wish there were some other way."
"I have to tell her the truth," Gabriel said. "She deserves nothing less."
"Will she understand?"
Gabriel shrugged his shoulders. Leia's affliction was psychotic depression. Her doctors believed the night of the bombing played without break in her memory like a loop of videotape. It left no room for impressions or sound from the real world. Gabriel often wondered what Leia saw of him on that night. Did she see him walking away toward the spire of the cathedral, or could she feel him pulling her blackened body from the fire? He was certain of only one thing. Leia would not speak to him. She had not spoken a single word to him.
"It's for me," he said. "I have to say the words. I have to tell her the truth about you. I have nothing to be ashamed of, and I'm certainly not ashamed of you."
Kiara lowered the duvet and kissed him feverishly. Gabriel could feel tension in her body and taste arousal on her breath. Afterward, he lay beside her, stroking her hair. He could not sleep, not the night before a journey back to Vienna. But there was something else. He felt as though he had just committed an act of sexual betrayal. It was as if he had just been inside another man's woman. Then he realized that in his mind he was already Gideon Argov. Kiara, for the moment, was a stranger to him. Chapter 4. Vienna. "Passport, please." Gabriel slid it across the countertop, the emblem facing down. The officer glanced wearily at the scuffed cover and thumbed the folio pages until he located the visa. He added another stamp, with more violence than was necessary, Gabriel thought, and handed it over without a word. Gabriel dropped the passport into his coat pocket and set out across the gleaming arrivals hall, towing a rolling suitcase behind him. Outside, he took his place in line at the taxi stand. It was bitterly cold, and there was snow in the wind. Snatches of Viennese-accented German reached his ears. Unlike many of his countrymen, the mere sound of spoken German did not set him on edge. German was his first language, and remained the language of his dreams. He spoke it perfectly with the Berlin accent of his mother. He moved to the front of the queue. A white Mercedes slid forward to collect him. Gabriel memorized the registration number before sliding into the back seat. He placed the bag on the seat and gave the driver an address, several streets away from the hotel where he'd booked a room. The taxi hurtled along the motorway through an ugly industrial zone of factories, power plants, and gasworks. Before long, Gabriel spotted the floodlit spire of St. Stephen's Cathedral, looming over the Innere Stadt. Unlike most European cities, Vienna had remained remarkably unspoiled and free of urban blight. Indeed, little about its appearance and lifestyle had changed from a century earlier, when it was the administrative center of an empire stretching across Central Europe and the Balkans. It was still possible to have an afternoon cake and cream at Demels, or to linger over coffee and a journal at the Landmann or Central. In the Innere Stadt, it was best to forsake the automobile and move about by streetcar or on foot along the glittering pedestrian boulevards, lined with Baroque and Gothic architecture and exclusive shops. Men still wore loden-cloth suits and feathered Tyrolean caps. Women still found it fashionable to wear a dirndl. Brahms had said he stayed in Vienna because he preferred to work in a village. It was still a village, thought Gabriel, with a village's contempt for change and a village's resentment of outsiders. For Gabriel, Vienna would always be a city of ghosts. They came to the Ringstrasse, the broad boulevard encircling the city center. The handsome face of Peter Metzler, the candidate for chancellor from the far-right Austrian National Party, grinned at Gabriel from the passing lampposts. It was election season, and the avenue was hung with hundreds of campaign posters. Metzler's well-funded campaign had clearly spared no expense. His face was everywhere, his gaze unavoidable. So was his campaign slogan, "Eine neue Ordnung für ein neues Österreich," a new order for a new Austria. The Austrians, thought Gabriel, were incapable of subtlety. Gabriel left the taxi near the State Opera House and walked a short distance to a narrow street called the Weiburggasse. It appeared no one was following him, though from experience he knew expert watchers were almost impossible to detect. He entered a small hotel. The concierge, upon seeing his Israeli passport, adopted a posture of bereavement and murmured a few sympathetic words about the terrible bombing in the Jewish quarter. Gabriel, playing the role of Gideon Argov, spent a few minutes chatting with the concierge in German before climbing the stairs to his room on the second floor. It had wood floors the color of honey and French doors overlooking a darkened interior courtyard. Gabriel drew the curtains and left the bag on the bed in plain sight. Before leaving, he placed a telltale in the door jamb that would signal whether the room had been entered in his absence. He returned to the lobby. The concierge smiled as if they had not seen each other in 5 years instead of 5 minutes. Outside, it had begun to snow. He walked the darkened streets of the Innere Stadt, checking his tail for surveillance. He paused at shop windows to glance over his shoulder, ducked into a public telephone, and pretended to place a call while scanning his surroundings. At a newsstand, he bought a copy of Die Presse, then, 100 meters farther on, dropped it into a rubbish bin. Finally, convinced he was not being followed, he entered the Stephansplatz U-Bahn station. He had no need to consult the brightly lit maps of the Vienna transport system, for he knew it from memory. He purchased a ticket from a vending machine, then passed through the turnstile and headed down to the platform. He boarded a carriage and memorized the faces around him. 5 stops later, at the Westbahnhof, he transferred to a northbound train on the U6 line. Vienna General Hospital had its own station stop. An escalator bore him slowly upward to a snowy quadrangle, a few paces from the main entrance, at Waringer Gürtel 18-20. A hospital had occupied this plot of ground in West Vienna for more than 300 years. In 1693, Emperor Leopold I, concerned by the plight of the city's destitute, had ordered the construction of the Home for the Poor and Invalid. A century later, Emperor Joseph II renamed the facility the General Hospital for the Sick. The old building remained, a few streets over on the Alsestrasse, but around it had risen a modern university hospital complex spread over several city blocks. Gabriel knew it well. A man from the embassy was sheltering in the portico, beneath an inscription that read, Saluti et solatio egrorum, to heal and comfort the sick. He was a small, nervous-looking diplomat called Zvi. He shook Gabriel's hand and, after briefly examining his passport and business card, expressed his sorrow over the death of his two colleagues. They stepped into the main lobby. It was deserted except for an old man with a sparse white beard, sitting at one end of a couch, with his ankles together and his hat on his knees, like a traveller waiting for a long-delayed train. He was muttering to himself. As Gabriel walked past, the old man looked up and their eyes met briefly. Then Gabriel entered a waiting elevator, and the old man disappeared behind a pair of sliding doors. When the elevator doors opened on the 8th floor, Gabriel was greeted by the comforting sight of a tall, blonde Israeli, wearing a 2-piece suit and a wire in his ear. At the entrance of the intensive care unit stood another security man. A third, small and dark and dressed in an ill-fitting suit, was outside the door of Eli's room. He moved aside so Gabriel and the diplomat could enter. Gabriel stopped and asked why he wasn't being searched. "You're with Zvi. I don't need to search you." Gabriel held up his hands. "Search me." The security man tilted his head and consented. Gabriel recognized the frisk pattern. It was by the book. The crotch search was more intrusive than necessary, but then Gabriel had it coming. When it was over, he said, "Search everyone who comes into this room." Zvi, the embassy man, watched the entire scene. Clearly, he no longer believed the man from Jerusalem was Gideon Argov, of wartime claims and inquiries. Gabriel didn't much care. His friend was lying helpless on the other side of the door. Better to ruffle a few feathers than to let him die because of complacency. He followed Zvi into the room. The bed was behind a glass partition. The patient didn't look much like Eli, but then Gabriel wasn't surprised. Like most Israelis, he had seen the toll a bomb can take on a human body. Eli's face was concealed behind the mask of a ventilator, his eyes bound by gauze, his head heavily bandaged. The exposed portion of his cheeks and jaw showed the after-effects of glass exploding into his face. A nurse with short black hair and very blue eyes was checking the intravenous drip. She looked into the visitor's room and briefly held Gabriel's gaze before resuming her work. Her eyes betrayed nothing. Zvi, after giving Gabriel a moment to himself, walked over to the glass and brought him up to date on his colleague's condition. He spoke with the precision of a man who had watched too many medical dramas on television. Gabriel, his eyes fastened on Eli's face, heard only half of what the diplomat was saying, enough to realize that his friend was near death, and that, even if he lived, he might never be the same. "For the moment," Zvi said in conclusion, "he's being kept alive by the machines." "Why are his eyes bandaged?" "Glass fragments. They were able to get most of them, but he still has a half dozen or so lodged in his eyes."
"Is there a chance he'll be blind?"
"They won't know until he regains consciousness," Zvi said. Then he added pessimistically, "if he regains consciousness."
A doctor came into the room. He looked at Gabriel and Zvi and nodded once briskly, then opened the glass door and stepped into the ward. The nurse moved away from the bedside, and the doctor assumed her place. She came around the end of the bed and stood before the glass. For a second time, her eyes met Gabriel's. Then she drew the curtain closed with a sharp jerk of her wrist. Gabriel walked into the hall, followed by Zvi.
You all right?
I'll be fine. I just need a minute to myself.
The diplomat went back inside. Gabriel clasped his hands behind his back, like a soldier at ease, and drifted slowly along the familiar corridor. He passed the nurse's station. The same trite Vienna streetscape hung next to the window. The smell was the same, too. The smell of disinfectant and death. He came to a half-open door bearing the number 2602C. He pushed it gently with his fingertips, and the door swung silently open. The room was dark and unoccupied. Gabriel glanced over his shoulder. There were no nurses about. He slipped inside and closed the door behind him. He left the lights off and waited for his eyes to grow accustomed to the dark. Soon the room came into focus. The empty bed, the bank of silent monitors, the vinyl-covered chair. The most uncomfortable chair in all of Vienna. He'd spent 10 nights in that chair, most of them sleepless. Only once had Leia regained consciousness. She'd asked about Dani, and Gabriel unwisely told her the truth. Tears spilled onto her ruined cheeks. She never spoke to him again.
"You're not supposed to be in here."
Gabriel, startled, turned quickly around. The voice belonged to the nurse who'd been at Eli's side a moment earlier. She spoke to him in German. He responded in the same language.
"I'm sorry. I know what you're doing."
She allowed a silence to fall between them.
"I remember you."
She leaned against the door and folded her arms. Her head fell to one side. Were it not for her baggy nurse's uniform and the stethoscope hanging around her neck, Gabriel would have thought she was flirting with him.
"Your wife was the one who was involved in the car bombing a few years back. I was a young nurse then, just starting out. I took care of her at night. You don't remember?"
Gabriel looked at her for a moment. Finally he said,
"I believe you're mistaken. This is my first time in Vienna, and I've never been married. I'm sorry," he added hastily, heading toward the door. "I shouldn't have been in here. I just needed a place to gather my thoughts."
He moved past her. She put her hand on his arm.
"Tell me something," she said. "Is she alive?"
"Who?"
"Your wife, of course."
"I'm sorry," he said firmly, "but you have me confused with someone else." She nodded.
"As you wish."
Her blue eyes were damp and shining in the half-light.
"He's a friend of yours, Eli Lavon?"
"Yes, he is. A very close friend. We work together. I live in Jerusalem."
"Jerusalem?"
she repeated, as though she liked the sound of the word.
"I would like to visit Jerusalem sometime. My friends think I'm crazy. You know, the suicide bombers, all the other things."
Her voice trailed off.
"I still want to go."
"You should," Gabriel said. "It's a wonderful place." She touched his arm a second time.
"Your friend's injuries are severe."
Her tone was tender, tinged with sorrow.
"He's going to have a very tough time of it."
"Is he going to live?"
"I'm not allowed to answer questions like that. Only the doctors can offer a prognosis. But if you want my opinion, spend some time with him. Tell him things. You never know. He might be able to hear you."
He stayed for another hour, staring at Eli's motionless figure through the glass. The nurse returned. She spent a few minutes checking Eli's vital signs, then motioned for Gabriel to come inside the room.
"It's against the rules," she said conspiratorially. "I'll stand watch at the door."
Gabriel didn't speak to Eli, just held his bruised and swollen hand. There were no words to convey the pain he felt at seeing another loved one lying in a Viennese hospital bed. After 5 minutes, the nurse came back, laid her hand on Gabriel's shoulder, and told him it was time to leave. Outside in the corridor, she said her name was Marguerite.
"I'm working tomorrow night," she said. "I'll see you then, I hope."
Zvi had left. A new team of guards had come on duty. Gabriel rode the elevator down to the lobby and went outside. The night had turned bitterly cold. He shoved his hands into his coat pockets and quickened his pace. He was about to head down the escalator into the U-Bahn station, when he felt a hand on his arm. He turned around, expecting to see Marguerite, but instead found himself face to face with the old man who had been talking to himself in the lobby when Gabriel arrived.
"I heard you speaking Hebrew to that man from the embassy."
His Viennese German was frantically paced, his eyes wide and damp.
"You're Israeli, yes? A friend of Eli Levon's?"
He didn't wait for an answer.
"My name is Max Klein, and this is all my fault. Please, you must believe me. This is all my fault."
End of Disc 1.